here a new generation of Christians who have a lot to look forward to. When we first did our Life Preparation Conference, we had as our anchor speaker Dr. Bonson. As you all know, Dr. Bonson died a few years ago. And this is kind of a generational connection. I wouldn't be here doing what I'm doing, and you know, Don Post wouldn't be here, and Steve Wilkins wouldn't be here, and George Grant, etc., if it weren't people like Greg Bonson who really shaped our mind to prepare us for the work that we're doing today. And so you're in a legacy movement. And many of you are you're awfully young. I mean, it's great to see so many young people here. Sometimes I wish I could go back and do things all over again. Getting what you're getting at this conference today this week is a remarkable achievement. I don't know if some of you realize how remarkable it is. But Greg Bonson was a unique intellect, knew his stuff better than anybody did in this topic. He was really set a standard for all of us in the area of scholarship and communication and so forth. I'm sorry that you aren't able to glean from his gifts and wisdom. But we're here because of people like Greg and Dr. Rushdoony and others, and who out of this group will be, you know, 15 or 20 years from now doing what I'm doing and what Steve and George and Dr. Veith are doing. You don't know what is going to happen to you. When I was 16 or 17 years old, if someone had told me that I'd be standing up in front of 200 kids and I'd be talking about what I'm going to be talking about, I would have said, you're absolutely crazy. It's an impossibility that I would be doing this. So you don't know what you're going to be doing 20 years from now. You just don't know. And so I would encourage you to take in this stuff, and if right now you don't see the relevance of it, at least store it away. And if God calls you and puts you into areas of ministry, call upon that knowledge and begin to use it, because you really don't know what God has planned for you. My background is somewhat diverse. My interests at your age were almost 100% athletics. Had no concern at all for intellectual pursuits. I like to read and I like to study, but what I wanted to do was to be an athlete and a coach. And in 1973, when I was a senior in college, my athletic career pretty much over, having found no direction in my life. God turned me around. Became a Christian my senior year in college, and from then on, God has just opened up tremendous numbers of opportunities. So even if you don't believe that you have certain gifts and talents to minister in these various ways, don't give up on yourself, because God's power, as the Bible says, is perfected in weakness. And sometimes the weakest element about you ends up turning out to be the gift that God will use in your life. And then you know that God's really doing it. Typically, it's not the strength that God calls upon, because you already know you have those, and you typically take credit for them. It's the weaknesses. God takes something out of your life and begins to mold it and shape it and to make it blossom and to grow and to give off fruit. So you might want to start looking in the areas in which you are most weak, and then God will take that and make it blossom. What I want to do in this first lesson is to deal with the issue of Christian scholarship and to deal with the myths of history and other kinds of things. And the first thing I want to do is to give you a Bible test to kind of demonstrate something. You cannot share this knowledge with anybody else. I know some are here from the other conferences, might remember some of these questions, but the person who gets them all right, I will give them $20. Okay? $20. A crisp $20 bill for the person who gets them all right. Pastors are not included. They cannot help their sons. Okay. And this is on the on the honor system. Don't blurt out the answers, because they may be wrong. They just show your ignorance. Okay. First question. Remember, say nothing. Where in the Bible do you find the following? Ashes to ashes and dust to dust. Where in the Bible do you find ashes to ashes and dust to dust? Just give me the book of the Bible, or better if you give me the book and the chapter. Number two, who cut off Samson's hair? Who cut off Samson's hair? Number three, Absalom's mule went under an oak in the Battle of Ephraim, and his hair became entangled in the branches, and he hung there while the mule went on. True or false? Absalom's mule went under an oak in the Battle of Ephraim, and his hair became entangled in the branches, and he hung there while the mule went on. True or false? Number four, another true or false, Noah's Ark landed on Mount Ararat. Noah's Ark landed on Mount Ararat. True or false? Number five, name the third, fifth, and seventh commandments. Name the third, fifth, and seventh commandments. You don't have to do them all out. Just a summary of the commandment will be fine. Number six, Jonah was swallowed by a whale. True or false? Jonah was swallowed by a whale. True or false? Number seven, how many wise men came to visit Jesus while he lay in the manger? How many wise men came to visit Jesus while he lay in the manger? Number eight, Jesus sweat great drops of blood, true or false? Jesus sweat great drops of blood, true or false? Nine, money, the Bible says, is the root of all evil. Nine, money, the Bible says, is the root of all evil, true or false? Number 10, where in the Bible do you find 666? Where in the Bible do you find 666? Number 11, where in the Bible does it say that Jesus will reign on the earth for 1,000 years? Where in the Bible does it say that Jesus will reign on the earth for 1,000 years? And last one, where does Jesus give us permission to watch television? Where does Jesus give us permission to watch television? Okay, let's see how well you did. See if I lose $20. If there's more than one person who gets them all right, you're going to have to split $20. They're not paying me enough to give away more than that. Number one, where in the Bible do you find the following? Ashes to ashes and dust to dust. If you said the book of Genesis in Genesis chapter 3, you're wrong. It's not found anywhere in the Bible. It's found in the Book of Common Prayer. Okay? Who cut off Samson's hair? Well, okay, if you said Delilah, you're wrong. It says that Delilah called for a servant to come in and cut off Samson's hair. Absalom's mule went under an oak in the Battle of Ephraim, and his hair became entangled in the branches, and he hung there while the mule went on. True or false? False. What got caught? His head, not his hair. People get confused because Absalom, what, had very long hair. So much hair, in fact, that it had weight to it. Number four, Noah's Ark landed on Mount Ararat. True or false? Where did it land? The mountains of Ararat. 5. Name the third, fifth, and seventh commandments. Number 3 is, don't take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. If you put up 3 fingers here, it looks like a W. Watch your words, the things that you speak about God. Number 5 is, honor your parents. It's like a salute, 5 fingers, honor your parents. And number 7 is, thou shalt not commit adultery. And that one you can remember if you put like 5, a stop sign, and put the 2, a couple behind it, and you can remember it that way, 7. Okay? Number 6, Jonah was swallowed by a whale. Everybody should have gotten this right. False, right. Swallowed by a great fish. Number 7, how many wise men came to visit Jesus while he lay in the manger? None. None at all. By the time the wise men came to visit Jesus, where was he? He was in a house. That's why when by the time the wise men get to Herod, Herod asks when they saw the star, that's why he kills the children 2 years and under. 8, Jesus sweat great drops of blood. False. He sweat, as it were, great drops of blood. Money, the Bible says, is the root of all evil. What does it say? Love. Where in the Bible do you find 666? Book of Revelation. How about nowhere? 666. There is a big difference. Not only because the text doesn't use 3 sixes, and you have to understand in Greek and in Hebrew, Greek and Hebrew letters are used for numbers. And so it's not the letter 6, it's the letter 600, it's the letter for 60, and the letter for 6. Where in the Bible does it say Jesus will reign on the earth for 1,000 years? Nowhere. There isn't a single passage in the entire Bible where it says Jesus will reign on the earth for 1,000 years. Okay? Some of you are looking at me and say, now, wait a minute, I've heard that all my life. Well, I'm sorry. It doesn't say that. The key word is earth. Where does Jesus give us permission to watch television? Okay, the book of Hezekiah. Hezekiah 6. No, that's not it. You see, Jesus, when he goes out on the Mount of Transfiguration, transfigured before some of his disciples, and as they were coming down, what did he say? Television to no one until you see the Son of Man rise from the dead. So if you believe in the resurrection, it's okay to watch television. No, actually it's not. How many got them all right? Except for the last one. You did, really? Well, you're not a kid, so you don't get the $20. Now, why do I give this test periodically? To prove a point. We hear things said over and over and over again that what's being said becomes the truth and the substitute for what is really true. Now, if this is true of the Bible, and look, these questions were easy Sunday school questions. I mean, these are things, I mean, I didn't even ask you questions that related to theology. What does this text mean? I just dealt with what does the text say. And here we have 230 people in this room, all growing up in Christian homes, all say they believe the Bible, and yet on basic questions, we don't know what the answer is. And anytime you do anything with the Bible, you're always asking these questions. What does it say? What does it mean? How does it apply? Well, if you don't know what it says, you're never going to get to the point of what it means, because you're going to be dealing with something that isn't true, and then finally when you get to interpretation, you're really going to be confused. We as Christians have got to be the best at what we say we know. We've got to know our stuff. And we have to be better at it than the opposition. That means going back and scrutinizing some things about the Bible itself, and we're going to talk about some of those things in the last two sessions. But also we have to deal with, no matter what it is, no matter what the topic is. And what we're going to talk about this morning is a little bit of history. The topic of this, the title of it, has to do with Roger Williams. He will be one of the things we're going to talk about. But what I want to deal with here is to go through some myths of history. When I was growing up, and this may be the case with some of you, I was told, for example, that Christopher Columbus sailed to prove that the earth was round because the religious leaders of his day believed that, you need to get that fixed, that the religious leaders of the day believed that the earth was flat, that they supposedly interpreted the Bible literally, and they talked about four corners and four winds and so forth, that the earth was flat. And so Christopher Columbus comes along, kind of a pre-modern. And with his scientific studies and his studies of maps and his studies of history and his studies of the ancients, that he was an iconoclast, that he was coming up against the medieval mind, the pre-scientific mind, and that he was going to demonstrate to these religious nincompoops that the world was indeed round and that they were wrong. And that's been the typical historical portrayal of Columbus and why he sailed. And I have textbooks even today that continue to push this idea. And it's so ingrained in our culture that we talk about the Flat Earth Society, etc., although there is one, but it's more of a joke than anything else. Did Columbus sail to try to prove that the earth was round because his contemporaries in the scientific field believed it was flat? Absolutely not. There is not a shred of evidence that would demonstrate at all that that was the view. Everybody in Columbus's day believed that the world was, in fact, round. That was not the dispute. What was the dispute? Hey, how big around the earth was. And in that, Columbus was wrong. Columbus thought the world was about 16,000 miles around, where the church officials, and you have to remember something, the king and queen were going to give away some money, lots of money. So they called in the experts of the day and, you know, said, look, king and queen said, look, I don't know enough about this. You guys are supposed to know. You need to quiz this guy. Like if some guy came in to me and said, I've got this great project and I want you guys to invest in it. And I said, well, tell me about the project. Before I put any money into it, I want to know what I'm spending it on. And Columbus was wrong. What saved Columbus's hide? And what put him in the history books? I mean, if Columbus hadn't done that, he would have been a footnote in history that would have said some guy named Christopher Columbus sailed and we never heard from him again. And that's the way the history books would have read, if even the history books had had that much in it about him. What happened was that this land mass that we now call the Americas was in between. He never made it to Asia, never made it to what was then the East. He got this big chunk of land, stopped him, providentially. That's why you and I are here today, because of that. But historically, what we're told is the church is backward scientifically, it is backward intellectually, and Columbus turned around to demonstrate that that was no longer the case and that we were going to show these things, and that's just not it. The Americas were in between, and as a result of that, Columbus becomes a hero for many of us. Now, who made up this myth? Where did it come from? Well, it came from a fiction writer named Washington Irving. He's the author of Rip Van Winkle and Legend of Sleepy Hollow. But obviously, he had an agenda, and that agenda was to ridicule the Christian faith. And here some of the greatest scholars of our day continue to perpetuate this myth. And this is one of the things you have to remember about doing intellectual work. Everybody has a worldview that they look through to evaluate the facts. And that worldview is prejudiced. It is biased. And we as Christians have got to admit that we have a biased worldview. We just maintain that our worldview is the worldview. Of course, everybody says that, of course, and that's what this defense of Christianity is all about. But our worldview, when we look at facts, we put them within that certain worldview context. Well, when unbelievers evaluate the facts, what do you think they're using? How do you think that they're evaluating those facts? What do you think they want to use them for? They want to use those facts to bolster their worldview. And even if they have to manipulate the facts in order to make it fit their worldview, they will do it. We, on the other hand, do not have that luxury. We are not permitted to manipulate the facts. We must speak the truth, even if it hurts. Those who oppose the Christian worldview, if they're evolutionists and so forth, while they do have a moral climate for things, they are not, in many cases, opposed to making up stuff. I mean, think of this latest CNN story. I don't know if you've been following this, the tailwind story, where major news forces, CNN, has had to fire some of their main people because they fabricated a story. And it probably had some political agenda attached to it. We as Christians don't have that luxury. We've got to tell the truth. But we have to train our senses and train our abilities to be able to discern what the truth is. But keep in mind that no one believed in a flat earth in Columbus's day. Now, here's another one. Galileo, the earth in the center of the universe. This is another thing where you have Galileo, who's the champion of secular scientific studies, and he's going against the church because the church believed that the earth is the center of the universe. And Galileo comes along and says, well, no, it's not. My scientific discoveries have taught me otherwise. Well, is the earth the center of the universe? Sure it is. Look, everybody knows, if you want to calculate how to get from here to the moon, what is your standard to use when you make that calculation? Do you think someone calculating how to get from the earth to the moon or getting from here to Jupiter is calculated by some unknown center of the universe? No one really knows where the center of the universe is. I mean, physically speaking. Do you think the calculations are made from that point? Where are all the calculations made? From here, from Earth. So even in our our secular scientific age, what are scientists using as the base, as the reference point in calculations regarding every other point in the universe? They're using the Earth. That's interesting. What is the Earth called? What's the Earth's name? It's the Earth. What is our moon? What's its name? It's the moon. All the other planets, all the other stars are given names except for our sun. It's the sun. Our earth, it's the earth, and our moon, the moon. Why? Because everybody believes we are theologically, philosophically, the center of the universe. And there isn't a scientific discovery today that would demonstrate otherwise. I mean, that's why all these scientists are sending probes out there trying to find somebody out there, because they want to prove that we're not the center of the universe, theologically and philosophically. They are so intent in showing there's got to be something else out there that will demonstrate that we're not the sun, the earth, and the moon. They haven't done it yet. But they live in terms of this is the center. Now, does that mean that we are the center in terms of its physical place in the universe? Well, no. But God, from our perspective, from the Bible's perspective, from the church's perspective, and even from our scientific era's perspective, this is indeed the center. And we live in terms of the center. But that wasn't the dispute in their day. The dispute was over, is the earth the physical center of the universe? The church said yes. Galileo said no. Now, what was the problem? The problem was this. The church had adopted an Aristotelian cosmology. It had borrowed from the Greeks. It had taken Aristotle's cosmology, his view of the universe, and had put that as the corrective lens, if you will, and the Bible was being read through Aristotle. And so when Galileo comes along and begins to attack the church, who in reality was he really attacking? Aristotle. And the church went ballistic. Because not only did the church adopt Aristotle's cosmology, the church also adopted Aristotle's morality. And the church believed that if you got rid of Aristotle, his cosmology, what would be the next thing that fell? The morality. So the Bible wasn't being attacked. It was only secondarily being attacked because the church had modified the theological centrist view of the earth and of our solar system in terms of Aristotle's view of reality. So Galileo did a good thing. Because we don't want to read the Bible through the Greeks. I mean, or the Romans. We don't want that worldview. We want nothing to taint our view of the Bible. In fact, we're still kind of, you know, steeped in this idea of the Greeks and the Romans and so forth. Even our founding fathers adopted much of what was Roman. I mean, the idea that we call a body of legislators the Senate. I mean, those are Roman concepts. And we have to be careful that we don't put another grid on top of the Bible and read through that grid as our interpreting model to figure out what the Bible has to say. Galileo did a good thing in that moving the church away from Aristotle, and we have to continue to do that as well. The church, in essence, read the Bible through Greek glasses. And all of us, whatever corrective lens you think you have in reading the Bible, you need to be rid of it. The Bible is the best interpreter of the Bible, not Greek philosophy. Now, the Aztecs. Cortez and the Aztecs. Now, reading the secularists today, if they were to take all of what we know about the Aztecs, they would say that the Aztecs, Montezuma and his people, lived in a utopian society. In fact, they were so ahead of us that they made great advances in heart surgery. The worldview of secularists is so biased and so prejudiced that they would take the sacrificial system of the Aztecs, where literally, this is what they did. They would take a victim, but they didn't perceive that person to be a victim because the religion demanded that they sacrifice people on a regular basis. They would take them up onto a step pyramid. There would be four priests, one holding, you know, two legs, two arms, spread that guy. Then they would get a flint knife, cut the guy open, and while the guy is still probably screaming, take the heart and rip it out and hold it up. Aztec heart surgery. The problem is they just never could get it to work in somebody else. And so what did they do with that guy? They would take him and throw him down the pyramid steps. And see, when Cortez came in, and when he saw all this, and you have to remember, those conquistadors, they must have frilly lace kind of guys. These guys knew war. They had seen bloodshed. They were horrified. They said the stench was worse than anything that they had ever smelled in their entire life. And then what would they do with those bodies? They would literally take them to the market square and sell the body part. The point being, when you ate somebody, you took their spirit upon you. If that person was a great warrior, you would take that spirit within you. They had mass executions. So, then you have to ask yourself the question, how was it that Cortez was able, with not that many soldiers and not that many great weapons, he did have the horses, and remember, the Aztecs had never seen a horse before, and they had armor, how did this handful of conquistadors beat this huge nation? Well, it was quite simple. The people around there were so afraid of Montezuma and his people, that they, as Cortez brought his men and started marching through the forest to get up there, they had literally thousands of people behind them say, "We want to fight these people with you." Because what they do is they come in at night, take our soldiers, kill them, take our daughters, kill them. And that's how they were able to defeat them. The surrounding the Aztecs so hated them that they joined with the conquistadors. But yeah, the Aztecs had a great nation, but it was a nation built upon fear and blood. And yet, as we hear our contemporary historians tell it, you would just think it was the next greatest thing to Moore's utopia. It was nothing like that at all. We're told that the Aztec utopia was spoiled by European culture. I mean, again, the history tells otherwise. And I have in my textbook, To Pledge Allegiance, you will see these old paintings descriptive of the heart being ripped out. You will not find those in contemporary textbooks. It's politically incorrect to blast the Aztecs. Then there's Roger Williams. Was Roger Williams a champion of religious freedom? In a certain sense, he was. And we just have to define what we mean by religious freedom. Now, Roger Williams was a Puritan, came to the Massachusetts colony, and right off the bat, he was something of a troublemaker. He didn't believe that the Puritan model had gone far enough in advancing the Reformation. Now, we had heard this before, and these Massachusetts colonists, you've got to understand something. Everything is precarious in the colonies. You never knew when you had enough food. You never knew if there was going to be a raid by the tribes around there. You never knew when disease would take over. Things were just always on the edge. And then to have Roger Williams come in and causing trouble within the church, they just couldn't have it. And they knew their history. Back in the 16th century, there were a group of discontented reformers called Anabaptists. The Anabaptists were so radical in the Reformation that they wanted to change the way the laws were established. They wanted to change the way social reform took place, some of it by the sword. Typically we think of Anabaptists today, Mennonite groups and the Amish, as being pacifists. But in reality, the Anabaptists during the 16th century were not like that at all. They were revolutionaries. And they were social revolutionaries, and that's why the reaction to them was so strong. Roger Williams was acting like the Anabaptists of the 16th century. They were fearful of him and wanted him out of the colony. And so they allowed him to stay in the colony until winter had passed, but again, Roger Williams, being kind of the rebel that he was, decided to take off during the winter on his own, and he founded what is today Rhode Island. And what's funny about all that, he goes into Rhode Island, and then who does he write to for advice on how to run a colony but Winthrop in the Massachusetts colony? He knew that you needed laws and you needed a system of civil government. And so he goes back to the very colony he left that he had so much trouble with, asking advice on how to run this colony. What was Roger Williams' problem? Roger Williams believed this. The church use the Bible as the foundation. So you want to know how a church runs, you use the Bible. But if you want to know how the state should run, you use a thing called natural law and reason. So over there, as long as you're in the church, you can use the Bible. But when you're over here and dealing with civil legislation, you use natural law and reason. Now, at first, natural law doesn't present a problem. In one respect, we're going kind of back to Aristotle again. Whose view of natural law do you use? Use Aristotle's view of natural law? We just don't know. And the reason natural law was able to operate, now natural law simply states that you can kind of figure out what's right and wrong by just kind of evaluating the world in which you live. But the reason natural law works under certain conditions is because people know this law. And so they said, the Bible says, "Thou shalt not murder," and people maintain, well, Yeah, natural law tells us thou shalt not murder. And I've never been able to figure that out, because if you really look at the created order, what do you find? You have animals killing one another, which seems to be rather natural. I mean, I don't know when the last time they've taken a lion and put it on trial for killing an antelope. I mean, it just doesn't happen. Why? Because that's the natural order of things. Now, the only reason this brand of natural law worked was because the Bible worked. It's as if that you had this. You have light from the moon. Natural law is like light from the moon. The reason you can see the moon is why? Because you've got the sun over there shining on it. If you didn't have the sun, what would happen to the light from the moon? There wouldn't be any light from the moon. It's reflective. The further you get away from biblical law, what happens to natural law? It ends up getting a life of its own. Who ends up interpreting what natural law is? Well, Rutherford said you use reason. Well, reason's not a bad thing either. It's kind of like this too. As long as it's governed by the Bible, reason's a good thing. But what happens? Because the Bible says, God says what? Let us reason together. As long as you reason together, that's good. But once you make natural law and reason independent of your sun's source, you're in trouble. And that's something Roger Williams did not anticipate. But the colonial theologians of the day did understand it. Because a time could come when, well, look what happened. You've got these Christians over here who are going to vote in the colony, and they're going to keep things okay. But what happens when the colony gets a group of people in here who don't like the Bible, and they start voting? Their concept of reason and natural law begin to change. You got a whole new definition of what natural law is. You got a whole new definition of what's reasonable. And this is where we are today in our own culture. We have cut ourselves off. In fact, you can't even talk about natural law anymore. If you're some, I guess most of you are too young to remember the Clarence Thomas hearings. What does Clarence Thomas want to say about what was his ethic? Natural law. And they went ballistic over just natural law. Even undefined natural law. Natural law that had nothing to do with the Bible. They took Clarence Thomas to task just for that. So what now is the basis of government in our society? No one knows anymore. There is no standard. The only thing that's kind of keeping us from folding under is because the Christian worldview still prevails in most cases. So, was Roger William a champion of religious freedom? Yes, he was. Problem is, he let any religion in. Any religious view was okay. Any standard was okay. Roger Williams today would be opposed to what is going on in the state of Alabama, where they want 10 commandments in the courthouse. Roger Williams would say no to that. So you can't have it. That's for the church. That's not for the state. The state should use reason and natural law. But who's bolstered in the secular, in the eyes of the secularists? Roger Williams. John Winthrop, you never even hear from the guy. We are now in the legacy of Roger Williams. What's happening in our culture today, religiously and politically, is a result of the worldview of Roger Williams. And our forefathers understood it, saw it, and saw the ramifications of it. So as we do history, I want you to understand that you are going to find that the evaluating history based upon the facts alone will not be enough. You're going to have to understand the operating presuppositions of those people who claim to be historians, and that's not always an easy task. So it's not just the facts of history that are important, but it's the underlying presuppositions that always come to play in interpreting those facts. And that's true with everything. That's like the creation-evolution model. Why is it that creationists and evolutionists, looking at the same data, come to different conclusions? It's not the data. It's the interpretive model that comes in and evaluates the data. One begins with the assumption that this stuff evolved. They may begin with evolution. Christian, on the other hand, comes and said this was all created by God, and therefore we can make better sense of all this. Not only is it is not enough just to know what the facts are, you have to understand what the operating presuppositions are. two last things. In doing research, checking original sources is imperative. And sometimes that's hard to do. Anytime anybody's written a book, he knows that relying on secondary sources can be a mistake. You get caught periodically. Someone will call you up and say, well, Mr. DeMar, where did you get the following? In fact, I got a call from one guy. He said, Gary, I've got two questions for you. And I said, I bet I know what the first question is. The first question relates to this quotation. We have staked the whole future of American civilization not upon the power of government, far from it. We have staked the future of all of our spiritual institutions upon the capacity of each of us to govern ourselves, to control ourselves, to sustain ourselves according to the Ten Commandments of God. Now, I put this in the very first book I wrote back in 1982 called God and Government. It was the first volume of God and Government. And this person who called me up on the phone, I just knew this is what he wanted. He said, Gary, what's the source for that quotation? I don't have one. I told him, I said, when I republished God and Government, I took it out because I could not find the original source. Supposedly, James Madison, fourth president of the United States, said that. But I have not found it documented anywhere. I finally traced it back to a January 1958 issue of Progressive Calvinism, which was a small magazine that came out, and its source, to show you how bad the reference is for this, was from a calendar of quotations. That's as far back as I've been able to find that quotation, a calendar. So obviously I don't use it anymore. Did James Madison say it? Probably not. Now, this is speculation on my part. Where did the quotation come from and why was James Madison's name attached to it? Well, James Madison had a cousin who was president of William and Mary College. And James Madison's cousin's name is James Madison. And he was a bishop in the Protestant Episcopal Church. It's possible that this James Madison is the source of that particular quotation, and it was attributed to James Madison, the president. So, when you do scholarly things and you do research, make sure you know your sources and what they are. Better to leave a source out than to put it in and someone call you on it. Because I'm telling you, you get on the radio, you write a book, and it's that one quotation that's dubious that they'll call you on. Then people say, oh, well, if that one's wrong, guess what? Probably the rest of your stuff is wrong as well. Here's another one. Alexis de Tocqueville wrote a work in about 1850. He was a Frenchman, French sociologist, came to the United States. He was a great observer of American culture and wrote a series of essays that now have become a book called Democracy in America. Newt Gingrich quotes from it all the time. And so apparently people think they're quoting Alexis de Tocqueville when you hear this quotation. I sought for the greatness and genius of America in her commodious harbors, in her ample rivers, and it was not there. I looked for it in her fertile fields and boundless forests, and it was not there. In her rich mines, in her vast world commerce, and it was not there. In her democratic Congress, and her matchless constitution, and it was not there. Not until I went into the churches of America and heard her pulpits flame with righteousness did I understand the secret of her genius and power. America is great because she is good, and if America ever ceases to be good, she will cease to be great. I have heard this quotation over and over and over again. Dwight D. Eisenhower gave it. Ronald Reagan used it. Bill Clinton actually used it as well. Of course, he'll use almost anything. An assignment was given to a first-year student at Claremont McKenna College, and they were to go and find de Tocqueville quotations used by people and find out how accurately they're being used. Well, some sharp student chose that quotation because it had been used so much and could not find it anywhere. Under further research, they found it's not in anything de Tocqueville has ever written. And yet it's used as if it's de Tocqueville. It's a great quotation. Someone obviously wrote it, but it's not de Tocqueville. So, what are we as Christians to do? We as Christians have got to be better than anybody else in our pursuit of the truth, whether it's in the area of scholarship, whether it's in defense of the faith, whether it's in the work that we do. We have got to be better. And there was a time that we were. We had the best schools, Harvard, Yale, and Princeton. We had the best in art. We had the best in music. We had the best in literature. We were the best. Now we seem to have an inferiority complex. And I think it's worse than that. I really believe that there are some Christians out there who maintain that we shouldn't be the best. That we should be second rate. That we should be the doormats of the world. All you have to do is look at some of the trash that's written in terms of, you know, I write books and, you know, I'm trying to get those books published by other publishing companies, and I get their catalogs and I see the trash that's out there. I see the book covers and how ugly they are and so forth. I hear some of the Christian music. Look, we are not being what God has called us to be. And that kind of mentality pours into the kind of work that we do in historical analysis and intellectual pursuits. And so, whatever God calls you to do, you have got to be the best at it. It doesn't mean, when I say you have to be the best, that means you have to be number one, but your pursuit of that has got to be the best. And then when you think it's the best, you need to go back and bump it up a couple of more notches. And so when you write something, it's not good enough. You've got to go back and look at it one last time. If you're an artist and a designer, you've got to maintain it needs a little more refinement. Because I'm putting it out there, I'm putting my name on it, and I represent something. It's got to be the best that you can offer. You have to challenge yourself and challenge your other brothers and sisters in Christ to go beyond what you believe that you are capable of being. Never settle for what you are today. Pursue excellence beyond anything that you could imagine that you are capable of at this moment. Because you are, in fact, capable of it. God will take the gifts and talents that are latent in you that you know nothing about, and He will force them out of you and turn you into something that you've never envisioned yourself to be. But the decision is going to be yours to make that decision as to what you want to do. And just kind of going back and looking at historical analysis and see that how people end up, you know, misusing the facts of history and reinterpreting the facts of history comports with what we ought to be doing in the world today. We've got to be the best at what we do for the advancement of Christ's kingdom. Thank you.